This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 169, A Boomer Backstory. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Tommy Kraft. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the latest on Tommy's film, Star Trek Horizon, and the fan pick for Best Alien Starships. Then in the feature, we're joined by Will Wynn to discuss the Enterprise episode, Horizon. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Tommy. It is so good to have you back here on The Ready Room with me. It's been a long time since we've recorded a show together.
It has, and I do love recording with Norm and Will over on Warp 5. We've done a few episodes together, but it's been a long time since we've gotten our band back together, and it's nice to do that.
Yeah, it really is, and it has been a long time. You know, you and I used to record a lot of Warp 5s together as well, actually more there than here on The Ready Room. And it's just great to talk again. You know, things have been crazy besides recording for me. You know, you and I haven't talked in a while. And we're into January of 2015 now, and I've really been wanting to know what's happening with your project, Star Trek Horizon, the film that you're doing. And now that I have you here, the first part of the news segment is going to have to be you telling me what's going on. So tell me the latest news and status of Horizon.
Well, let's see where to begin. It's basically just me working day and night now on post-production because we finished. Actually, I don't think you and I have recorded since we finished principal photography.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. And even that was, I think, around the first week in November. And so since then, you know, I haven't actually finished cutting together the entire film, because I'm working so much on the CG aspects. So I'll do some CG, and then I'll do some cutting of scenes, and so on. And even right now, as we record, I have the bridge rendering for scene 36, and it's shot number 4, just in case you were curious. And that render has been going for 22 hours so far, and we're on frame 120.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's one of the big bottlenecks that I've been having too, is that it's a lot of rendering. And but the cool news here is that basically the entire opening of the film is almost done. So we have the Iconian scene, which was released with the Kickstarter way back last May. And then we have the scene that directly follows that, and that's almost done. And then the scenes that follows this scene are mostly done. So we're getting to a point now where I'm lining up a lot of stuff, and it's actually really rewarding to see it all come together like that. And beyond that, just plans for the future. I'm planning on doing another trailer in the next month or two as well.
Well, speaking of trailers, here's one question that I had for you. In the full trailer that you released in, was it the end of October?
Yes.
I believe when that came out. So you've got Romulans there at the beginning of the trailer. I know that you made the Enterprise uniforms, and we've talked before on Continuing Mission, I think in depth about making uniforms. Did you make those Romulan uniforms as well?
I did, actually. And one of the cool things about that is I can do a little shout out to a guy named Arthur Lane. He somehow found our Facebook page a number of months ago. It might have been around the time of the Kickstarter. I have a hard time remembering now. But he shot me a message, and he had acquired this fabric. I think if I recall right, he said, he saw a picture online, and this lady just had it, sitting in her closet. And so he got in touch with her, and he's like, hey, can I get this fabric? Because the fabric is an upholstery fabric, that you use for furniture. Mm-hmm. And it's no longer in production. And even when they used it for a Nemesis Enterprise, they got it on sale. They basically just went out to a store and was like, oh, that looks cool. Let's make Romulan uniforms out of it. And so Arthur came across this, and he shot me a message, and he sent it to me for free, which was incredibly generous of him. He even covered the postage costs, which was nice because it was a very heavy bolt of fabric.
Yeah, it's probably some serious postage.
Yeah, it is. And so I got that, and that was one of my favorite finds because it's such a rare thing to find. The jumpsuits are just made out of blue denim, so you can get that anywhere. But I made that jacket, and it's actually only one jacket that I've made and repurposed for everybody. And that is one that I put together myself as well.
Cool. How long did it take you to make that?
I think it took me probably about 3 to 6 days solid work because I fully lined the jacket too. So it is an actual real jacket that you can wear out. It's working with that fabric was a challenge too because it's a very heavy fabric. So most of those uniforms and costumes actually did take quite a while, especially because I'm not the biggest fan of sewing. And so it was sometimes a challenge to force myself to sit down and work on it.
Well, you might not be a fan of sewing. And you said 3 to 6 days on that Romulan uniform. And I'm thinking that at this point, you are a master seamstress after all those Enterprise uniforms that you had created. So I think you're pretty fast. It probably would take most people a whole lot longer than that.
Well, thank you. I mean, at the start, it did take a very long time. And the first jumpsuits I did were terrible. And, they took me weeks to put together. And I would be sewing things, and I would rip out all the seams, and I'd have to sew it again, and it still came out terrible. And so, I mean, yeah, because 11 or 10 to 12 jumpsuits later is the amount I made in the end. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point. And plus, there's the Admiral's jacket. For our Admiral Gardner, I did that as well. And so the fun thing is now, though, whenever I look at a piece of clothing, I can say, oh, now I see how they made that. I know exactly the technique they used.
Well, the good thing about those early jumpsuits that didn't turn out so well is that you can use them on crew members in battle scenes, right? After they've been injured or a conduit has exploded on them.
Well, that would actually be a great idea, except I just wound up cutting them up and ripping out all the zip, because there are 13 zippers in an NX uniform.
Wow.
And so, I would buy zippers in bulk. The people I bought zippers from probably thought I was making some kind of zipper bomb or something because I was buying so many of them. And so those two uniforms, because I'd buy them 12 at a time, so that's 24 zippers right there. So I wound up ripping out all the zippers and all the pockets, and I'd cut them up and reuse the fabric. And at that point, they probably really would have been great for an injured crewman when half mm-hmm. the legs are cut out and everything.
Well, so a new trailer is coming up fairly soon. Do you know when that's going to be? Any general time frame?
I want to say within the next month or two. And the reason I want to be pretty general about the date is because I want to be able to put on the trailer what the exact release date of the movie will be.
Okay.
And so once I'm ready to commit to that is when the trailer will be out. And as we've mentioned at some point, that I'm doing most of this by myself. And so it's hard to set exact dates because I can't send this off to some kind of production house or to a group of people and say, and get her, you guys can work on scenes 8 through 41 and you'll have it back to me by X date. It's, I'll work on all couple hundred scenes and I'll also wait for every 24 to 90 hour render in between mm-hmm. for a shot that might only wind up being 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And that is the main bottleneck here. But I want to be able to have it out, the movie, by the Q1 of 2015 at some point.
Yeah. And of course, this isn't always the only thing you're working on, right? I know when Prelude to Axanar was being produced, you were doing compositing on Axanar, so you're mixing that in with your Horizon right. work as well. Is stuff like that still going on for other things?
Yeah. In fact, Mark Edward Lewis, who did a lot of the sound on Axanar, has contacted me about the possibility of doing CG work for him, and I've had other people in the area that would like me to work with them. Mm-hmm. And that is in my local area that they're working on films. And Horizon is still definitely my main gig and what I spend the majority of my time on, but there are other gigs too as well, which of course takes away from that. But I will say the render times have turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because it keeps me from getting burnt out, because yeah. I can then find an excuse to take a day off. It's like, oh, the computer's rendering anyway. I can't do much, so I'll take the day
off. I'm technically still working, right?
Exactly. So even when I'm not working, I'm working.
That's right. Well, good. Well, that's good to hear that Mark has contacted you, because, mm-hmm. I mean, as I told you very early on, that I mean, your skills are going to be in high demand in the years to come, I know. So great to hear on that.
Yeah.
And it's great to hear that things are moving along. You know, I was watching the full trailer again, the one that was released in October, looking at all the action that's going on in there, the space scenes, battles. And again, I was just thinking the whole time, like, my goodness, Tommy's doing all this stuff himself. I don't know how he does it.
I don't either. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's a lot of madness, I think, is how I managed to do it.
Well, we're all glad that you are, and we're looking forward to seeing Star Trek Horizon when it comes out. And the one other thing we're going to talk about news today, I put this in here specifically because you were on, because it's about ships, and I was just mentioning ships there in the trailer, and you've designed these ships for your film, of course, NX-class ships, but also Romulan ships in there, and other types of ships and scenes that you've done. So I thought you would be a good person to weigh in on the StarTrek.com poll that was up recently, where they asked which alien race had the best starships. And they had more than 25,000 votes cast. So tell us what the results were.
Well, the results are not necessarily what I would have picked for all of them, but they're interesting results. The top pick, well, actually, you know, I'll go from the bottom and save the best for last, as it were. The bottom number, 1%, Ferengi ships. Interesting. We actually haven't gotten to see much of their design, really, outside of smaller shuttlecraft.
Yeah, not much since season one TNG, where we got to see some Marauders, but
yeah,
after that, not too much, right?
And even in DS9, we didn't really see too much. We saw their homeworld, but not really much of their spacecraft. Interesting, number 2% of people voted for Cardassian, which is fascinating because I always thought their ships were quite popular among the fans. They have very, very unique design. 4% Andorians, good ships, but only 4% of the vote. 10% Vulcan, the ring ships I always thought were a pretty cool looking design. 21% Borg, this is third place now. And I guess cubes are pretty popular with people. Geometric shapes, cubes and spheres.
A lot of cubists out there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm fine with that. 27% Klingon. And that's number 2. And number 1 winner for best alien ships are the Romulans at 33%.
Mm-hmm. So who would you have chosen as number 1?
Oh, that's a... I suppose I should have had a good pick since I was complaining about some of these results. But I really am tempted to say the Cardassians because I have a...
Really?
Okay. Yeah, because I have a soft spot for the Cardassians. My only complaint there is that we don't see a lot of individual Cardassian classes of ships, which might keep me out from putting them as number 1. Number 1, actually, I might go with Romulan as well.
Yeah,
because they have such a varied design element over the course of all the series. We see a lot of different Romulan classes from a lot of different timelines, and they all look Romulan, but they all still have their own unique feel to them.
Yeah,
and green is my favorite color.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, then you have to choose Romulans.
Exactly, yeah. Or the Borg.
Yeah, the Romulans being first here doesn't surprise me too much. I think Romulans and Klingons are probably who I would have guessed would be first and second. With the Romulans, I can see that because not only do you have the green ships, you know, the big warbirds from the TNG era, you've also got, well, sticking with the green theme, you've got the great retro birds of prey from Enterprise.
Yes.
From the 22nd century. Of course, the 23rd century birds of prey with the bird painted on the bottom of the hull, those are pretty cool.
Yeah.
Especially if you see one that's done up in high res, not just the
We
saw in the original series. That's kind of a cool design, and they have interesting shuttlecraft as well. Klingons, the thing about the Klingons is I've never been a huge fan of Klingon ships in general. I think the birds of prey are cool, the ones like we got from the films, which carried over into the later series. Those are pretty cool little ships. The big warships, you know, the cruisers and all, they're okay. I probably kind of have a soft spot for something like a D7 because of the original series, you know, and growing up with it. But the design of the Romulan ships might be a little bit more interesting. And Borg, they started coming up with some interesting Borg ships towards the end of Voyager.
Yeah, they did.
The different types of armor and the way that they were colored. And then you've got the spheres as well as the cubes. And those were pretty cool. I remember when we saw the sphere come out in First Contact in the theater, I thought that was kind of cool and unusual. And then, of course, they ran with that.
Right.
So, and then when you go down for the rest of these Vulcans, I think the ring ships are an interesting design, but, you know, they're so limited in scope. We see them in Enterprise, and that's kind of it. And Dorian ships, I never really cared for personally.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan either. They're interesting, but...
Yeah, well, blue is my favorite color, so I like the bridge. I like all the blue around.
And, of course, the skin tone.
Yes, yes.
Just saying, if Ferengi women are your thing.
But the external, you know, the exterior design of the Andorian ships, I never cared for very much. Cardassian ships, never cared for very much personally.
Really? How come?
I don't know. Just something. I mean, I guess they fit
too
the
fishy
culture.
For you?
No, I don't know what it is about them. Something about the shape. I think they fit the culture pretty well. So from a design artistic standpoint, when you're trying to... I think that the designers did a nice job with the Cardassian culture of creating architecture on the planet, creating uniforms, creating ships, creating interior architecture on Terok Nor/DS9 that all fit together really well. And now I like the sort of Art Deco inspired architecture inside DS9, but the ships didn't do so much for me. Ferengi ships, interesting design, although I think they would have been nicer, like if they came with different skin tones, like skins for the ship, like you get a skin for your iPad or your phone.
Right.
So they could have leather, they could have fur. You know, tie into that that kind of Ferengi thing. Maybe slug skin. I think that would probably be popular with Ferengi as well.
Yeah, probably.
The ships that I like, which were not an option on the poll, are the Jem'Hadar ships.
I was just going to mention that, too. I think that those really should have been on there.
Especially the, not the big battleships, but the ones that we see most of the time where, you know, like Sisko and the crew stole this sort of little fighter. Those, I love the purple coloring that they put in those.
Yeah, it's very unique too. You don't usually see that.
And another thing I think is interesting about those, which I think goes unnoticed a lot, is that those ships look like insects. And when Sisko's talking in Rapture about the locusts, swarms of locusts, it really feels like a possible reference to the Dominion fleets and the Jem'Hadar ships. So,
that's actually a good point. I never thought of it that way either. But now that you mention it, that's, I wonder if that was intentional on their part, on the writer's part.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if it was or not. I think it probably wasn't. I think it's coincidental, but I think it's a nice little tie-in.
Yeah.
So I like that. And the other ship that should be on here, of course, I mean, if we're talking about cool ships, Zerillion ships from Enterprise. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Any ship that has grass growing on the floor and edible walls
yes.
should be on a list.
That's a good point. And of course, now that we're thinking about Enterprise, some of the Zindi ships were pretty cool looking too.
Yeah, yeah, there were some cool Zindi ships as well. So those would be things that I would have added. I guess you need to have the best known races on here, which is why maybe
right, yeah.
Vulcans, Andorians, Cardassians, Ferengi are on here.
It's just interesting because some of them, like the Ferengi, don't really have much in the way of ship design. It's not very varied. So it's kind of hard to put that on a poll because there just isn't much to pick from. And I think it's ultimately, too, why the Federation is probably most people's favorite, just because you see so many Federation starships and it's yeah. so iconic.
Right. And the detail that goes into them.
Right, I mean, yeah.
If people want to know, go find the continuing mission episodes where Tommy and I are talking about 3D rendering and set design and all. And, you know, you talked on there, Tommy, about the time and the detail that you put into recreating the NX, or, well, the NX class anyway.
Yeah, and it's a testament to the original designers as well, because there's just so many tiny details on those things that you don't realize when you're just watching an episode casually. And yeah. it's the kind of thing that I noticed when I started zooming in on pictures, you know, at 400% and just staring at it for minutes at a time. And to be fair, they do tend to do that a lot with alien ships as well. They just don't get as much recognition because there's not nearly as much screen time for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cool. Well, let us know which alien starships are your favorite. You can do that in the Babel Conference on Facebook. On Facebook, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it'll come right up. It is a closed group, so if you're not a member right now, you need to click join, and I'll let you right on in there. But we have great discussions over there, and that'll be a great place for you to share your thoughts with us on alien starships. All right, Tommy, well, we're going to keep talking about Enterprise a bit more as we bring in Will, so let's jump into our discussion about Horizon. Fans often cite Mayweather as the most underdeveloped part of Enterprise, but the episode Horizon sets out to change that perception with a story focusing exclusively on the Ensign, his family, and his past. It's a good look into the character, though surprisingly it comes near the end of Season 2, and we're going to talk about this episode today and help us do that from our Enterprise show Warp 5, as well as content coordinator for us here on the network. It is Will Wynn. Hey Will, welcome to the Ready Room.
Glad to be on here.
Yeah, this is your first time on the Ready Room, isn't it?
It is. I guess in Archer's time, the Ready Room is smaller than the brig on the Enterprise D, right?
That's right. And just think how small it is on the ECS Horizon.
I mean, pretty much it's a closet, probably.
Probably, yeah. All right. Well, it's great to have you here on the show with us. Before we jump into the discussion here, a quick synopsis for those who haven't seen this episode or haven't seen it in a while. The Enterprise is directed to go to a planet for a scientific mission to observe some volcanic eruptions, some new thing for humans. And just so happens that the ECS Horizon, which is the ship that Travis Mayweather grew up on, is there on the way to this planet. So they drop Travis off to visit with his family. Of course, he finds out that his father has passed away before they get there. So it's a good chance to revisit the family, his home, talk with his mother. But along the way, there are some rough edges. His brother is a little bit miffed that he left the ship and went into Starfleet. And of course, you need a little danger in Star Trek too, so they come under attack by mysterious aliens of the week. at the end of the day, Travis saves the day, goes back to the Enterprise, and everything's good. So that's the basic rundown of what happens in the episode. Of course, there's a movie night as well, which we'll talk about. So, guys, when we were picking an episode, this was one of several we were talking about, and you guys both said, we're picking Horizon. Now, Tommy, does this have anything to do with the fact that your film's called Star Trek Horizon, or are you a big fan of Travis?
That's the only reason, just because I'm really narcissistic and it always has to be about me. So.
Okay.
No, but I actually do. I do like this episode a lot, and I like Travis a lot, and I wish he'd gotten more attention.
And Will, you also told me you're a big Travis fan.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you said it before, he really is the most underdeveloped character, but arguably, I think he has one of the most, you know, potential, he has a really strong potential to have really great substantive storylines, especially I think the relatively unexplored Boomer aspect. So I just wish I saw more of him.
And also, Travis is just a nice freaking guy. Does anybody else ever notice that? Like, that's what I love about Travis more than like any other character. He just seems like a nice guy.
He's like a Boy Scout, really. He reminds me of a human Nog, but with kind of without the Ferengi eccentric personality quirks. But he really is Nog in a lot of ways.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. That. Okay.
I've never looked at it that way either.
Well, that explains why he keeps asking Hoshi to chew his food for him.
Right.
That's true.
Well, this story is, it feels like a story that we needed early on in season one. And in fact, I kind of accidentally picked up the season one box off the shelf to pull out the disc for this and then remembered, no, wait, this is season two. And not only is it season two, but it's the 20th episode of season two. So it's right there at the end. And the Blu-ray set, it's on the fifth disc of the set.
Yeah.
And, but not only the story itself, but the feeling of it as well. That opening scene with Travis up there in the sweet spot. And then he gets paged from the bridge. And they take a long time for him to get down there to the comm panel and actually respond to Hoshi. And even just that feeling from a directorial standpoint felt like season one as well. Will, do you feel like this episode should have come early in season one instead of late in season two?
Absolutely. I think the sweet spot was one of the my favorite things from the pilot episode. I think it really is a visual touchstone in terms of saying this is a different type of Star Trek. It's a much earlier form of Star Trek. They're moving around in this sweet spot like how the astronauts move around in the International Space Station. They're moving around. It has that feel, and it's so great. And it's I forgot about it. I mean, seeing this episode, like, oh, yeah, they totally forgot about that aspect of it. And I just totally wish that, you know, we saw it earlier. And it dovetails with my belief that season one is a lot stronger than people give it credit for because of these little moments like this.
Yeah. Am I right, Tommy, that this is... Well, I don't know if it's only the second time, but after Broken Bow, we don't see the sweet spot very much at all, do we?
No, in fact, I was just going to ask that same question to make sure I was right, that I'm pretty sure that this is a direct callback to Broken Bow, and I think that's actually kind of neat because it shows you that they haven't forgotten the little details that they set up way back in the first episode.
Or maybe it shows you they haven't totally forgotten them because they did kind of forget about it, right? Because it seems like the thing that you would see more often, like Travis goes and hangs out in the sweet spot. I feel like, you know, even on TNG, certainly on DS9 or on Voyager, you would have those places where certain characters go or things that certain characters do, even minor characters that you would see over and over. And this feels like that thing for Enterprise, especially because of the way they set Travis up. And I guess if they had done that more often up to this point, it wouldn't be so jarring when you see it in that opening scene that it's like, wait a minute, this seems like a very unusual opening.
And it's the last time you see it in the series too.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's probably because they didn't have very many Travis-centric episodes.
Right.
They didn't have any other reason to include the location.
But wouldn't it be cool if, like, say, maybe Malcolm and Trip, they go hang out in the sweet spot and Travis doesn't know about it. And then one episode he walks in and he's like, what are you guys doing in here?
That would have actually been a great little dynamic, little scene between them.
It would have been very wacky, but it wouldn't good.
Or how about in Vanishing Point, where Hoshi's trying to get people's attention? What if it turned out that the sweet spot was the only place where she could go to finally get people's attention and she could be saved?
Well, that would make as much sense as anything else does in that episode.
We should really do an episode where we rewrite certain episodes, kind of like what To the Journey does. Just like, let's
it's
rewrite Vanishing
We do
Point.
That sometimes. We did that on Warp 5 for Extinction.
Ooh.
Because, you know, Extinction is an episode at the beginning of season 2 of Enterprise that has a very interesting premise and has a fantastic director in LeVar Burton, but just turned into a complete mess on screen. So, yeah. Well, okay, talk a little bit more about the Travis elements of the story. You know, we find out about his family, which I thought was very interesting and very important for fleshing out this seemingly forgotten character on the crew. And we learn about his past as well, which I think is important that if you're going to set him up as a boomer, he grew up on a cargo ship. You really want to know more about what was that like, right? So for you, Will, did you learn what you wanted to know about Travis in this episode, or did it plant seeds for things that you wish they had followed up on?
I think it definitely planted seeds. I think for me, this episode is pretty much the epitome of why I have almost a love-hate relationship with Travis. I love the few morsels that they give us, but then it also makes me hate it because that's all they give us, right? They have this really rich backstory of boomers. Before Starfleet, humans have been in space for quite some time. It's this completely different ecosystem. It's completely different from Starfleet, and it's so tantalizing from a prequel aspect especially. And then you see his family, and you see that relationship, you see that dynamic. And then it's completely dropped. And I think for me, just seeing that, I was great to kind of really see this episode kind of flesh that out. But at the same time, knowing that this only goes for 4 seasons, knowing that this is pretty much it, kind of frustrates me too.
That's actually a great point about Starfleet too, because when you think about it, I wonder how many races cargo ship captains and crews would have made first contact with. It seems like there's this huge area in Star Trek history that we have now with the cargo haulers, especially being before Starfleet, that just kind of gets glossed over, even in Enterprise. And it's too bad that they didn't explore more of that, because I think there's a lot of potential history there.
It has very much a Firefly, Battlestar Galactica feel to it, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
The clothes, the jackets, the feel, the cargo containers. It's almost like, should there be a prequel to Enterprise to explain this period? I mean, it almost feels like it could be, right?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you guys. If they did a Star Trek series that was about the cargo service and about the people that live on those ships and their experiences, would you be interested in that? Would you watch that as its own show? And then I was thinking, well, you know, we have Firefly's kind of like that. I mean, in terms of feel, Firefly's a lot like that. But A, would you watch it? And B, do you think the average Star Trek fan would be interested in a show like that?
I don't know, because it seems like at the time Enterprise was on, the average Star Trek fan wasn't even interested in Enterprise.
True.
And that was, I don't think it was that big of a departure, but even that was too big of a departure for a lot of Trekkies.
Yeah.
And I think you would hear a lot of people say, well, why is this even a Star Trek show? Just make it a space show about people hauling cargo.
Yeah.
And I guess there's some merit to that, but I think there's also a lot of opportunity there for Star Trek stories. I don't know how interested Trekkies would be, though. I would be.
Yeah, I would echo that, too. I feel like I would absolutely be on board with that, but I feel like I'm not the representative cross-section of just Trekkies that would be tuning into the show. And
right.
It's a tough line to walk, because there is really interesting stuff to mine there. But if you don't have almost those touchstones of the nacelles, the saucer, all those, the bridge, that callback, a lot of people will say that, like, you're just ripping off Firefly, you're just ripping off Farscape or something. And
yeah.
Almost like you can't win, right?
Yeah, I agree. I feel like I think there might be an audience for that show, but you would have to take it not as Star Trek, just take it for what it is. which is kind of like what I tell people for Enterprise. You know, like if you're upset about Enterprise, if you feel that it's not the Star Trek that you wanted, try not to frame it that way. Just watch it for what it is, and maybe you will enjoy it more. Tommy, you mentioned something that was interesting about how many first contacts they might make with different species. And I would assume it wouldn't be too many just because of the time it takes them to travel from place to place. You know, they wouldn't have as many opportunities because they spend so much of their time in deep space. But what I also find interesting about the idea of first contact in this case is that, let's say you're in deep space and you meet another alien cargo ship. The interaction between those two crews is a bit different than the interaction between the average people on planet A and the average people on planet B. I think of it, like in my case, because I live in Japan and have lived here so long, when I meet people from other countries here, they're generally not representative of their own culture that much, because these are the people who have decided that they want to travel and live abroad as well.
Right.
So they have kind of a different mindset. And I think that's interesting as well, just to think about what, you know, information exchange and what the personalities would be like, and the cultural exchange in those cases.
That's an interesting point, because you're essentially saying that the people who don't want to stay where they come from are not going to be the best representatives of that culture, because they're not necessarily that interested in their own culture.
Yeah, well, and by the word best, we don't mean that they're bad. We mean not the most representative of the average person in that culture.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's a good point, actually. I had not thought of that. It would be interesting to see the cargo haulers' interest in making first contact and how they would respond to that. Would they even really have interest, or are they just concerned really with getting from A to B? Are they interested in discovering? I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, I would think maybe with the slower warp speeds, would they even have a high probability of meeting new species that isn't already within, I guess, Starfleet's umbrella or theater of operations, if you will. I'm sure there are instances where they will encounter things, which begs another question of, do they have their own protocols? Does the ECA have their own protocols? Do they defer to Starfleet? Because what you see in this episode, there's a lot of resentment. A lot of the cargo haulers hate Starfleet, and for good reason, right? And I think that's interesting right there, those nuggets of, we are not one big happy fleet yet. Like, we're not united. People resent each other. And, you know, I don't know. Do they have new protocols?
Do they care about the protocols?
That's also true.
I
think they would be a lot more casual, personally. I mean, maybe there's some protocols that they would follow, but certainly not what we're accustomed to in terms of Starfleet first contact protocols. Because these people are more concerned about getting through the day, their lives, their livelihood, you know, where their food is coming from as well, making sure that they make their deliveries on time, and which is an interesting concept, isn't it? If you think about space travel, making your deliveries on time, what would the real window be there?
Right. That's true. Your window like a two-year window, you know?
Being realistic about it,
Right.
Yeah,
it won't be like the Next Generation where, like, oh gosh, we're 3 hours late to the conference.
That's true. And I guess with the idea of getting packages on time, there's a clear indication here of profit motive, right? They're making their money. They're talking about, and it's again kind of different than what we've been led to believe in other Trek iterations, right? It's just completely a different ecosystem.
That is a good, the money is a good question, and it's something I've always wondered about. And I think they kind of dodge that question in a lot of Star Trek. They just kind of casually say, oh, we don't have money. But I mean, man, that's a huge deal to not have money. And it's only even dealt with once in Enterprise in the first episode, when Trip says poverty, disease, hunger, we got rid of all of that. And I think at some point in there, they mentioned not having money or something to that effect. But what do the cargo people use for money? I mean, if human society doesn't have money, obviously they have to have some sort of way to barter with the people they're trading with, that they're delivering cargo to. So yeah, I just think, in general, in Star Trek, and especially in Enterprise, I think they should have really handled that a lot more, because it's one thing in Star Trek I most desperately would like to see, and that's the dissolution of money in our society, but it's also the most unrealistic. So I wish they would talk about that more.
Well, and occasionally you get a mention of Federation credits in Star Trek from time to time. So it's like, we have no money,
but
we
have,
Federation credits. So
it's like that meme that was just posted in the Babel conference where, you know, it's the Federation symbol, the Federation emblem, and it says, we don't use money or understand it unless we need to use it, and then we use it and we understand it, right? It's just very Jekyll and Hyde relationship.
Yeah.
I think it's one area where Star Trek is never really fully committed to its premise in that sense, and I wish it would.
Well, if the original premise is that there is no money, I don't find that to be a realistic premise in the first place.
Right.
So it's kind of hard to stick to something which, you know, I mean, is it possible? Yeah, I suppose it's possible, but it's so difficult for you to tell stories that way because the audience can't really wrap their minds around what that would
mean.
Well,
and that's why I would like to see them deal with that more, because that is the premise sometimes, and I think that there's ways that you could make that believable, but they just never really sort of commit to it. They just kind of throw it out there. And even one in an episode of Enterprise, Trip says to somebody, I'll buy you lunch. So is that just an expression
left over?
It's just
an expression, yeah.
Right. Or is he actually paying Chef for the food?
It's an old Southern expression. I'll buy you lunch just means I will just replicate it for you, or protein
I'll
resequence
press
it.
Press the button.
Yeah, we don't use that expression up here in the North in Michigan. It's only a Southern thing.
All right. Well, here's a question about Travis, again, as we're talking about the culture on cargo ships. Remembering that he grew up there on the ship, and then he leaves, he goes to Starfleet, he's now the helmsman on the first Warp 5 ship, so he's surrounded by state-of-the-art technology for the time. Then he goes back to the cargo ship that he grew up on, and he starts introducing all these upgrades to their systems. Just thinking from his perspective as a person, his brother's very upset that he left the ship, which I find to be a selfish point of view from his brother's side, because Travis has opened up new horizons. I have to use the word here. For himself, you know, he's grown as a person. He's learned new things. He's going back. He's trying to share that. Did you feel like he's kind of showing off for Nora, or showing off to his family, or genuinely trying to help his family, which is more what I see when I watch it?
I think he was genuinely trying to help. But I also understand his brother's position, because as we grow up, there's a strong tie there to our family, and especially I've dealt with illness in my family, and then the mm-hmm. own question of pursuing my own career is like, at what point do you make the transition between staying home to take care of ill family members and moving forward with your career, that kind of thing? And so I very much get his brother's position about, he feels that Travis was the one being selfish because he had responsibilities and didn't do them.
Yeah, I think for me, I think Travis did genuinely want to help too. I think the fact that he was doing all these technical upgrades, for me, even that I was able to buy, because early in the episode, you know, he mentioned that, you know, his father and everyone on the crew had to have multiple jobs, right? His mm-hmm. father had, I think, the record 5 jobs on the ship, 2 on the bridge. So, they, you know, chief engineer, chief medic. So it wouldn't be beyond reason that although Travis is trained as a flight controller, helmsman, that he would also know a lot of engineering as well, right? And he could probably do first aid. So I buy that. But, you know, at the same time, I do understand, I think in a different way, Paul's resentment of Travis, because it kind of touches back on Fortunate Son when they pick up Ryan, and how Ryan just has this knee-jerk reaction towards Starfleet. And with Paul, I'm sure there's that resentment of Starfleet layered on top of that familial resentment, because Travis was the one that was supposed to replace the father, not mm-hmm. Paul. And just because he left, it kind of was almost like he became captain by default. He was a second choice. So I feel like he has this giant chip on his shoulder, and layer on top of that.
So you feel like Paul is upset at Travis because he had to become captain instead of Travis, as opposed to him being upset that Travis wasn't there for his dad when he was sick and wasn't there when his dad passed away?
I think it's probably, I think it's probably both, because I feel those types of emotions aren't necessarily rational. Sometimes when you break it down that way, it seems contradictory. But for someone like him, I could buy the fact that he could hold contradictory emotions. The one time kind of resenting Travis, but also wanting him to be there.
Okay. Well, I get the wanting him to be there part. The part that I had not thought about that you said is him being perhaps resentful that he had to become captain. I hadn't really thought about that. I kind of have always read it more as him being upset at his brother for not being there for the family. Maybe he is being thrown into a situation that he isn't really ready for, which is what other people, some of the crew feels.
No, I think what I was trying to say with my original point was maybe he wasn't necessarily resenting the fact that circumstances made him be the captain, but the fact that he wasn't the one that was supposed to be the captain.
I see.
It mentioned before that I think Travis was being groomed to be his father's successor, and that he left and he was kind of left there by default. Obviously, he probably would have liked the circumstance to be better when he became captain, but I think in the back of his mind, he always had that kind of, I was a second choice.
Yeah.
And also, him being forced to become captain puts a lot of responsibility on his shoulders that he might also be resentful about, too. You know, he feels like, man, all these people's lives, I'm responsible for their lives now because Travis went and left.
Yeah. And he's clearly not ready for that leadership role. You can tell that. And I actually think that was played quite well.
Yeah.
You know, the feeling that, this is an uncomfortable situation for me. Mentioning that Travis was being groomed to take over, the part where they're going through and they're doing the inventory, and Paul mentions that their dad kept a lot of the inventory in his head, and so there aren't any records. That's something I thought was a very realistic point, because now, of course, it's bad management practice to do that. But I can definitely see that in that situation, if someone's been the captain of a cargo ship for a really long time, and if most people on the ship are your family as well, I can definitely see him keeping a lot of the information in his head because he just knows how it runs, he knows where it's supposed to be, and it's easier to do that than to spend a lot of time on bookkeeping. But then when a tragedy like that strikes, it does put everyone else in a tough situation, which is very realistic.
Yeah, I mean, this is why we have life insurance, because, I mean, there's in everyday life, we have so many things that we just kind of, we have our own system. And if something were to happen to us, then somebody else would have to pick it up and figure out what we were doing. And I mean, even if you were to take it from a much less serious perspective, when I'm working on the movie, if I go back into a project file for a scene that I haven't worked on in 6 months, you know, I even have a hard time picking up my own project file because I don't remember what I was doing in this scene, in this project 6 months ago, let alone if something were to happen to me and somebody had to take over the movie and finish it themselves.
That means you should have a number one, Tommy.
That's right. True.
Well, I was going to say what you need to do, Tommy, is you should have a camera across the room filming you working all the time. So then you can go back and you can watch the tape of yourself working on that file 6 months ago, and then you'll be able to see, you'll remember what you were doing.
And then the problem is, though, I have to remember my naming scheme for the footage files of me working, and I have to try and find which day I was working. And see, it still doesn't work. It doesn't help.
Well, what we've been talking about here with Paul and Travis and their father passing away is something that it kind of struck me, especially watching the episode this time, as being similar to my own life. And it's something that I think doesn't affect the majority of people these days, because most people either live near their families, either in the same town that they grew up in, or they live fairly nearby, or maybe they live, a 3-hour drive away or something like that. Whereas, I live on the opposite side of the world and I live on an island as well. So it's very, difficult to move around. And when Travis is having the conversation with Archer, this is after they got news of the tragedy, and he explains that my mother sent a subspace message to Starfleet 6 weeks ago, but I never got the message. It reminded me that we're seeing this a bit today in our own lives through globalization and as people move around, and it's obviously an inevitable part of life in space when you start dealing with especially the cargo ship culture, where you don't have super high warp engines where you can, you know, zip around places. You're going to be in situations where things happen to friends or family, and you have to just watch from the sidelines. You're not able to be there for them. You're maybe not even able to attend funerals of loved ones, which has happened to me as well. You know, my father passed away about 3 years ago, which is one reason this really struck me with what Travis was talking about, because same situation, his father passed away and he couldn't be there and he couldn't attend the funeral. And I, the same situation for me. And I think that I think we're going to see this more and more as time goes on. And obviously if humans do move out into space, which hopefully we will, otherwise we may not be around for a whole lot longer, on the time scale of, you know, the centuries passing. It's something that's going to affect us all. And I mean, I guess the question here is, do you guys feel like that kind of realism, if it were worked more into Star Trek, would it enhance the show, the reality of the show for you? Or do you think it would detract from the storytelling?
I think it would have to, I guess, depend upon the plot of each episode. Mm-hmm. I think certain arcs and certain stories have to be told in an almost real time or instantaneous way. But I feel like, especially with the prequel nature of Enterprise, this is something that they could have explored, particularly when they're looking at colonies or they're looking at ships that are not Starfleet, or they're just visiting planets for the first time, that there really is like a time lag between what's going on in the ship and back at, you know, home. And I think one of the great things about another episode, I think called Breaking the Ice, was when Archer and the crew were giving the letters, or they were responding to the letters from that first grade class. And I watched that and I was like, that's incredible. You never really see this in Star Trek. And if only they extrapolated from that in terms of, you know, them being in space, things have changed back home. Maybe, you know, they kind of allude to it a little bit, but with, I think, Tripp's old flame that kind of like moved on, but like really get this, sell the sense that things are changing. Time has passed. How we perceive time on a ship is going to be different than that. You know, people will have birthdays and weddings and marriages and deaths. And it would be a great episode for the crew to kind of really get that collective realization that when they've been off exploring space and doing all these exciting things, that they've also missed a lot of important things back home too. And a lot of it could do with, you know, a time lag. That makes sense to me.
I think it's an interesting question from a Trek technology perspective, because I've always wondered what the H is a subspace message.
Yeah.
And even in Enterprise, they do this like it's nothing. They'll be 100 light years away, and Captain Archer will have a no-lag conversation with Admiral Forrest in his ready room, right, or in his quarters. And so from that perspective, it just doesn't make sense that it would take 6 weeks for Travis to get a message about his father passing away.
I think the only way I can retcon it is, I think Archer said that the civilian comm channels can be really slow. So in my mind, I retcon it in the way that in Earth, there are still very different organizations. The Makos have technology beyond Starfleet. So is the Earth cargo service, you know, the opposite? Do they have technology that's actually far inferior to Starfleet, therefore their networks are 6 weeks slower or something?
I think in the 22nd century, the civilian channels are still operated by Charter, and therefore, you know, if you send too many messages in a month, they start throttling you. So
are you just making 4G that up? Limits yeah. In the 22nd century,
because it sounded really legit.
Well, that's what they do. I mean, these companies in the U.S. especially, they start throttling your internet at the end of the month.
Right,
actually, this
true.
Show, when the early days of the Ready Room, when my co-host Greg was in Seattle, he would get throttled at the end of the month, and it would become almost impossible to record this show because his internet would be so slow. And then when the new month rolled around, everything was back to normal again.
It's too bad he wasn't using subspace messages.
Yeah, we could have done it by subspace postcards.
There you go.
How does that even work? Is that like a euphemism, or you like write something and then you transfer into like a subspace carrier wave? Like, that makes no sense to me.
It's probably kind of like how we get e-cards today.
Yeah, I guess.
Except I'm thinking that they could combine it with 3D printer technology. So you send the subspace postcard, and then it actually prints an actual postcard right there.
That's actually a really great idea.
Yeah.
So I'm going to remember that for like 40 years in the future, and I'm going to suddenly become an entrepreneur.
Excellent.
You know, when 3D printing is really readily available, and then you can just 3D print postcards to people because everyone will have one in their house, a 3D printer.
That's true.
I have a feeling everyone's going to have a 3D printer in their house in about 10 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I'll remember it for then.
It's going to happen sooner than you think, I do believe. All right. Well, one other thing I wanted to talk about is Entertainment Tonight and Movie Night. Movie Night is one of my favorite parts of Enterprise, and we've talked about it many times, I know. In this episode in particular, first of all, I feel a lot of flirtation from Trip to T'Pol anyway, when they're kind of, he's trying to get her to come to Movie Night and she doesn't want to come. I like the way she resists the idea of Movie Night. But by the end of the episode, she wants Frankenstein to be required viewing for all Vulcans when they arrive on Earth because she thinks it'll help them understand better how people are going to react to them.
It's a very Spock moment because that type of humor is very dry. It's very droll. And you start to see, oh, she's starting to loosen up a little bit. She's kind of like getting the vibe, the relationship. So for me, it's like, that's a joke that Spock would make. And then McCoy would be like, oh, is that an actual joke? You made a joke? It's the same reaction. So for me, it makes a lot of sense. But it also, at the same time, you realize, is she also being kind of serious? You know, because she's actually relating to possibly a very serious event in terms of first contact, that there were humans that viewed their arrival with fear and distrust. So it's almost like that's another aspect of, I guess, post-first contact, pre-Enterprise that we never saw, is not everyone welcomed the Vulcans with open arms, right? So there were people that actually did kind of think that way. So what happened there? So
yeah, it was not everyone was listening to Ooby Dooby and drinking.
That's very true.
Once the hangover wore off, the next day everyone realized what had actually happened.
That was the deleted scene from First Contact, of course, what really happened.
Yeah, test audiences thought the ending was kind of slow as everyone was waking up from the hangover and decided that, you know, beaming up to the ship was a better closing.
Yeah. No, I really like that ending scene, too, with T'Pol, and it's really expertly played by her, too, because it's one, I mean, pretty sure she's joking, but you also do, as Will said, you have that question of maybe she's being kind of serious here. And it's like Spock, but it's still her own take on it. Mm-hmm. And also the looks too on Archer and Tripp's faces are classic as well. I mean that kind of subtle acting, I think, is really underappreciated by a lot of people.
And I think that her reading of Frankenstein, though, was a lot better than their reading of Frankenstein, because she actually was understanding what Mary Shelley was trying to say a lot more than they were. But, you know, earlier in the episode, she was trying to get Trip to have someone read the novel to everybody. And he says, well, if you want to start a book club, you go ahead. But it is that sort of thing. Like, you know, if you've read the novel, if you've read Frankenstein, you understand a lot more what the story's about, as opposed to the film where you've, you know, they're playing up the pitchforks and sort of the people being upset at the monster. A little bit more from a visual standpoint, you know, it's not quite as deep as what the book is. And I think that she, being a Vulcan, picked up on that a little bit more.
That should just be a Twitter feed, like T'Pol's book club. And it's just it's almost like Film Critic Hulk or like Lit Crit Hulk. It's like T'Pol's book club and reviewing like famous books, but just in a completely like droll Vulcan way. I would totally
in 140 characters.
That'd be great.
That'd be awesome. That would be like that. What is it? InfoSec Taylor Swift? Is it? There's that account of someone. It's supposed to be Taylor Swift giving tech advice.
Oh, that's awesome.
I wish I had an imposter on Twitter.
Then you'll have to change your name from Doggy Dog to the right. Real Tommy Kraft or the real Doggy Dog.
That's true. Yeah, if anyone steals my Doggy Dog name, I'm going to be PO'd.
I also like how much she resists movie night. She finally goes after being ordered to be the captain's date. So I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
But what I like is when she finally gets in there, she really gets into it and she becomes like a normal person in the theater when she tells the guy behind her to shut up.
Yeah. That was a great scene. That was Phlox she told that to, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Phlox.
Yeah.
And I also love how Phlox starts breaking down Dr. Frankenstein's technique.
Yeah.
You know, that's the doctor. It reminds me of in A Matter of Time on The Next Generation when Rasmussen is there and he's asking all the questions and then Worf asks about or makes a comment about phasers. And Rasmussen's like, see, seeing the past like a warrior, you know, asking about weapons. And here it's Phlox getting into the medical technique of Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah, that was a great little character moment for Phlox.
And leave it to Phlox to, I think, him really breaking that description down and totally missing the point of how that could totally come off as incredibly creepy or like just the way he's just breaking down, you know, Frankenstein or Dr. Frankenstein's methodology or is how he makes a monster. He just does it in such a happy-go-lucky, not even a clinical way, just like, oh, as a matter of fact, this is what they do. This is not creepy
at all. And going
back
to your point, Chris, once again, T'Pol was the only one that got the point of the story.
I think so, yeah.
Which is kind of funny. I'd never looked at it that way before.
I could see Data breaking it down the way Phlox did, though. Like, he would also latch on to some technical aspect of it like that.
I would have also liked to see a theater scene in Enterprise, kind of like with TNG. You know, we could have T'Pol and Phlox in the play and maybe Trip.
Well, Trip has a harmonica, right? So they could start like a jazz quartet.
Oh no, he does still have. Yeah, they mentioned the harmonica in the episode. I was just thinking if this was after North Star, but no, North Star is in season 3 because North Star is the point where they wrote the harmonica off the show.
Because he gave it up for the bartering chip.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's
so David
right.
A. Goodman
right.
hated the harmonica. And so he wrote it. I don't know why, but he said he hated the harmonica. So he wrote it out of the show in North Star.
That's the one.
That's
like the one piece of canon he really cares about. Like, man, I'm really glad I wrote off the harmonica. That's my proudest moment in Enterprise was doing that.
I love the harmonica. Shows what I know. They could have done like a Southern Trio or something. You know, Malcolm, I don't know why Malcolm, but he could have played the banjo.
Oh, man, I could see Malcolm with the banjo.
Yeah.
And then Phlox could play the jug.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
Oh, man.
That'd
be great, too, with the way, with as expressive as his mouth is, too. He could probably get some good sounds out of that jug.
Because
Phlox does that big smile, you know.
He'd be going, and then when he has rests in the music, he could just turn and do the big smile at the crowd while Trip and Reed keep playing. Yeah.
This is good stuff for another Warp 5 episode right here.
Yeah, you know. And then the concert could be followed up by a good catfish dinner.
That's true. And, of course, you'd have to have the pie for dessert, the pecan pie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just don't serve any pineapple, though, because then Malcolm won't be able to play.
Well, no, he's taken the injections for it, though, the bromelain.
Well, so. But what if Phlox forgot to give him his injections because he was too busy rehearsing his jug part?
That's true. And then suddenly things turn very serious for the Southern Trio.
And there's your episode.
There you go.
It's like A Night in Sick Bay, part 2.
Yeah.
That's right. It sounds like an episode of Seinfeld, actually.
It does. Yeah, it kind of does. The show where nothing happens.
That's right. Well, last thing about movie night. Did you guys also notice that T'Pol broke the little taboo about touching food when she actually takes popcorn out of the bucket?
That's a good point. I never noticed that.
and she's chewing it very, I want to say, is she chewing it angrily, passive aggressively, or is he chewing it thoughtfully, like, ooh, do I really like popcorn? Is it kettle corn popcorn? Is it buttery? Like, is thinking in her head, like, this is actually better than I thought? I mean, it's just,
she's thinking,
it's very subtle.
This is butter, cheese. I think I taste a little bacon in here.
It would have been great, too, to see her pick that thing up with a spoon or a fork.
Yeah. I would like to see her. Now I could see, because I eat always with chopsticks, picking up popcorn with chopsticks, one kernel at a time.
That would be a pretty great image.
but she struggles with chopsticks. Remember that one line, I forget which episode, where I think Archer said, oh, you missed T'Pol with chopsticks.
Oh, yeah.
And then Chip was like, oh, a dinner and a show? Because she's just that bad with chopsticks, apparently. I don't know.
Oh, what episode was that too? I remember. I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
I'm gonna have the memory alpha it, but it's it's there.
She could get Phlox to give her some lessons because he loves going to the Chinese restaurants.
Loves that true. Egg drop soup.
Although I will say, I find Chinese chopsticks much more difficult to use than Japanese chopsticks.
There's a difference.
Well, Japanese chopsticks are tapered on the ends, and Chinese chopsticks are not.
Oh,
it's a lot easier to pick up food with tapered ends, I find.
I've been to one Japanese restaurant in my entire life, and it did not go well. And I felt like such a northerner when I said to the waiter, "I'll have the tenkatsu ramen," and then I couldn't eat with the chopsticks. It was probably one of the worst experiences.
Oh man! So for those wondering what that is, correct would be tonkatsu ramen.
Yes, that's exactly how he said it, too, when he repeated it back to me, and I felt even more stupid.
That's great. Okay, well, one last thing to talk about here as we get ready to wrap up is the ending of the episode, when these Mino aliens come. This almost felt like a Voyager thing to me, the mysterious aliens of the week who come in, because, say, on DS9, of course, it's very structured. You know, we're always dealing with the Cardassians and the Bajorans and people. And on TNG, when we encounter aliens, most of the time, we kind of know who they are. You know, even if they're people we don't see often, like Nausicaans, we're familiar with these aliens. But on Voyager, because they're traveling in a straight line through the Delta Quadrant, they keep encountering people we've never seen before. And here, we again have mysterious aliens of the week who are really just here to set up a situation where Travis can save the day. And then Travis saves the day in such a quick fashion, and then everything's okay with his brother, and he goes back to the Enterprise, and I personally felt like the resolution was a letdown. How did you feel, Will?
I agree. I think it's falling within the parameters of what a 44 or 45-minute show can do. And I think, obviously, there are limitations with that. And you see at the very end how all of a sudden, all you need to do is detach the ship from the rest of the cargo. Then it flies around in an almost starfighter-like way.
Yeah.
That shoots these little laser beams, you know, expertly, takes it all out completely, no problem. And then the denouement with Paul and Travis is it's done very quickly, right? You know, they reconcile. And, you know, I think it's done as well as it, you know, should, I mean, as well as it could have been within the 45-minute time frame. But, you know, this is something that, you know, later on you see in season 4, they do those 3-episode arcs. I mean, this has been a prime topic to kind of do a mini arc about the boomers, right? Like their struggles surviving literally on a, you know, a warp 1.5 ship, right? They don't have all the resources. And, you know, Travis can't just MacGyver something literally in 30 seconds, right? They have to think of something more ingenious, but it takes more time. The villains literally aren't just a brand new villain. There's more of a buildup and more of a foundation laid. But within the context of a single episode, I mean, they did a lot with it. I think it worked, but I mean, at the same time, it's just kind of like, all right, just kind of wrap that up and then not even tell Archer about it. It's almost like, did that even happen really? So it's a love-hate type thing.
I think that's a good point, and it suffers from the issue that a lot of procedural TV shows suffer from, and you see this with a lot of the other Star Treks, of you set up something in the episode that could be a really interesting premise to continue storytelling, but you know as soon as they set it up 5 minutes into the episode that you find yourself trying to figure out, oh, how are they going to do away with this by the end of the show? You know, it's like what I think is the most terrible episode of DS9 ever, where Dax falls in love with the guy and the planet that's phasing in and out of existence, out of this plane.
Oh, man.
And you know as soon as, like, okay, well, how are they going to make it so she doesn't have to quit her job at Starfleet? Yeah. And, you know, the planet, it's... And that could actually, if it was done right over like a 2 or 3 episode span or at the end of a season, it actually could be, I think, a very interesting premise. And it's the same with the cargo haulers. And Will, you got me thinking about it when you're talking about how they did the 2 and 3 parters. Like this, if they'd really restructured the story and done it as a 2 or 3 parter, they could have told some really interesting stories, not only centering around Travis, but what we were talking about earlier of exploring this unknown history of Star Trek about the cargo haulers. And there's a lot of territory there they could have covered. And I think it was, while this episode was good, it was a hugely missed opportunity.
Yeah, I like the idea of it being a 3-episode Boomer arc, because then you could have had the cargo be something that someone wants for a specific reason, so that what we see at the end of this episode isn't the end of the attempt to get that cargo away from them. Travis could have stayed longer, and like you said, it could be more about the struggles of the Boomers there, of the cargo service. And also, as a TOS prequel, instead of having Mysterious Alien of the Week, bring in the Orions.
Oh, we know. I was just going to say that.
We know, yes. This is what the Orions do in the first place, and we don't get Orions until the 4th season. Here's a chance in season 2 to bring in the Orions. That would have been more interesting. But if they're not going to do an arc with it, I would have at least preferred for it to be a case where when Travis leaves the ship, maybe things are a little bit better with his brother, but it's not like, oh man, you know, everything's great. I'm so glad you dropped by. Make sure you send me a postcard. I really love you, bro. Instead of that, you know, it's sort of like it's still tense. And then you can have another episode down the road, maybe 10 episodes down the road. Again, forgetting, throw out the fact of what happened with season 3. Okay, we're just thinking about, as you're watching this in first run, you don't know what's going to happen yet. Come back to it maybe 10 episodes down the road where it's Travis and his brother again, and kind of resolve that and stretch it out a little bit more. It's just the you know, everything's okay in the final minute that I found to be a bit of a letdown here.
I think it just stems from the fact that at this time they were really trying to avoid anything that was remotely serialized.
Yeah.
And I think, especially in this kind of show that does nothing but harm your storytelling, because it forces you to really limit what you can do with your characters in the long run. And that's why I think over seasons 3 and 4, you see, is when you really, and season 2 as well towards the end, when you really start to see Archer developing and changing as a character. And it's just, too, from the fact that they didn't serialize much, and Travis wasn't obviously that important to them. So it's a combination of issues, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's wrap up here with our final thoughts and our ratings for this episode. So, Will, tell us your final thoughts and your rating.
So, I think as you mentioned in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
I have very much a love-hate relationship with Travis, because for me, he's the perfect metaphor for Enterprise. What you see, you want to see more of. Ultimately, you don't see more of it. From what you see, there's really interesting stuff there. And I think for me, especially coming from the past, the 2 shows that came before, Deep Space Nine and Voyager, they had very diverse casts. And by the time it came to Enterprise, you had Anthony Montgomery, Alinda Park, the 2 actors of color, the only actors of color on the entire show. For them just to be so marginalized story-wise, for me, always kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And on top of that, knowing that Travis has such an interesting backstory, it's such narrative gold there that they never really bothered to explore, for me, rubs me the wrong way. But at the same time, there actually is, for what we do see, some really good stuff that's there that is now part of canon that I'm happy that's there. So for me, it's a perfect metaphor for Enterprise. You talk about it, it's great, but then you're like, if only they could have done X, Y, and Z. So for this episode, I think for the most part, it does a really good job of kind of cramming everything you knew or forgot about Travis into 45 minutes, but there are some things that could have been done better. So I will give it 3 strawberry shortcake Nutri-Pex out of 5.
All right. Those are good, you know.
Apparently the ones in the plastic or the aluminum foil is way better than actual shortcakes, which sounds completely crazy to me. Like, that's not possible, Travis.
Apparently so. I like what his mom says. I think they've spoiled your taste buds. It sounds like she's saying, like, these damaged your taste buds, right?
Yeah, pretty much. These. It's like saying, like, ooh, a Pop-Tart's so much better than this, like, creme brulee. I'm like, are you kidding
right.
me?
You know, I was on your side until you made the Pop-Tart analogy.
Ooh.
Because I really like Pop-Tarts. But
do you like the creme brulee Pop-Tarts better than a real creme brulee?
Well, okay, see, that sounds pretty disgusting. But I might rather have a cherry or blueberry Pop-Tart than rather actually eat a cherry or a blueberry.
So how about this analogy? Like a Hot Pocket as opposed to a calzone, like preferring a Hot Pocket to like an actual
I don't know,
calzone.
Will. You're making some enemies here today.
Uh-oh. Okay, I'll stop.
All right. Well, Tommy, what are your final thoughts and your rating?
Well, I think they're going to kind of echo Will's. It was a good episode, and it was nice to see some area explored with Travis, but I think they could have done a lot more. And actually, during the course of this conversation, I probably would have given it a 4 out of 5 before this, and it kind of changed my mind. It's one of those. There are those episodes that you look at and you think that was really spectacular. I really wouldn't have changed much, or anything I would have changed is just nitpicky stuff. And in this case, I think they could have done a lot more with at least a 2-parter arc or continuing the story later on down the road. And as we said, I don't like how the ending was just wrapped up really quick. All of a sudden, everything's fine now, yada yada. So I am going to give this 3 out of 5 Pop-Tarts.
Do Pop-Tarts exist in universe? That's a good question.
I'm going to go ahead and say that they do exist in universe, even if you know the Pop-Tart company has gone out of business by this time, then surely somebody will have carried on the tradition, because well, Pop-Tarts are just that great.
You know, I've heard through private channels that Chef's actual name is Chef Kellogg, so...
Okay, that's pretty good.
All right.
I forgot that they were Kellogg's, too. I probably sound really stupid now.
I think they're Kellogg's. I hope they're Kellogg's.
Are they Kellogg's? I don't know. I just see the Pop-Tarts, and I just grab them and eat them. Okay. Like, practically right there in the store, I just grab the box.
All right. Well, I agree with what you guys have said. The one thing for me, and you pretty much said this, Will, is that Travis has this great backstory. But beyond that, if you think about it, with the exception of Archer, Travis may actually have the most developed backstory of any character on this show. And so the fact that the writers couldn't do more with this character when they actually knew more about his history than they did the other characters continues to baffle me. And so when I watch this episode, it's actually a bit frustrating to know that they could have done this episode in the first half of season one and built upon it and given Travis just as much stuff to do as they gave the other characters. The episode itself, I really like. I think it's one of those episodes where maybe it's a bit slow for the average Star Trek fan. You know, it's very talky, but I like those kinds of episodes myself. I think this is somewhat in the vein of like Shuttlepod 1, which is very talky, but you learn a lot about the characters, which is really nice. And I would have liked to have seen more of this. But I do like how they tie a B story like Movie Night in with what's happening on the horizon, because it's a bit about family too. You know, it's about bringing the crew together And the crew's a family on a small ship like this. And then you've got T'Pol, who's resisting being part of that. And then you've got Travis, on the other hand, who's actually willing to give up his commission in Starfleet, or at least take an extended leave and stall his career, or just go back to be with family. So that ties together pretty well. But in the end, I do find the ending kind of unfulfilling, and I'm disappointed that we didn't get more follow-up on it. So I'm going to give this episode 3 pitchforks and 2 torches.
Interesting choices. I just want to say, too, based on, like, I've been rewatching a lot of TNG again. I haven't watched it in a while. And holy Lord, is that a talky show.
I find it
interesting because you mentioned like some of these episodes might be too talky, and I don't know if like a lot of Trekkies just haven't really gone back and rewatched a lot of the old shows. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing for TNG either. I just had forgotten like there's very little action in that show of any kind,
yeah.
And very, very much talking.
I think by the time you get to this point, though, Voyager had shifted a lot more towards more action happening compared to those TNG episodes. And so then when you shift gears back to something like this, it's a lot slower paced than what we were getting towards the end of Voyager. You know, not every week, but once the Borg took over, we were getting a lot more, you know, action stuff on Voyager. So
there's just something about that soft lighting, those beige colors, those earth tones that just make conversation just so much more easygoing, palatable. Just like the Enterprise D bridge is just, you just want to like just relax there. It's just so nice.
It's so homey. Yeah. I that was my thought too. And I've been rewatching him. It's like, wow, this ship really just feels like home. You know, it's just so comfortable.
Well, think about the NX-01 crew. If they got moved over to the 1701D, you know Trip would be turning the bridge into movie night.
Yeah. That huge view screen. Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
That would be fantastic. All right. Well, Will, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we go, tell everyone where they can find you around the network and around the interwebs.
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter. I'm at @Will_Nguyen. It's spelled Nguyen. And of course, I'm in the Babel Conference, which is Trek FM's dedicated Facebook listeners group. And I'm also the content coordinator for the network. So if you have an idea of what we want to talk about, or linking different themes between different shows, or you've thought of a new angle that we haven't thought of, just drop me a line at Twitter or my email at will.win@trek.fm.
Great. Well, thanks again, Will. It was great to have you on the Ready Room for the very first time.
It's my pleasure.
Well, I think that was a great conversation, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm glad you could come on along with Will, especially since you guys are doing these Warp 5 episodes together now. It's great to bring that over here onto the Ready Room.
Yeah, it's almost like we have our own serialized storytelling going on now. And we're having guest stars now. We're doing crossover spots.
That's right. Well, speaking of serialized, if we could make as much money as Serial, that podcast, then we could really expand the network.
Or if we could make as much money as Pop-Tarts.
Oh, well.
Because, you know, cereal, get it, cereal company, makes Pop-Tarts, see?
Yeah. Boy, we're full of Kellogg's jokes today, aren't we?
Oh, yeah.
All right, yeah, well, it was great talking about Travis and Horizon, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Really, really, really hope that if they do that, they make Chang the villain, because, you know, Captain Chang instead of General Chang or whatever, mm-hmm. You know? I mean, that just seems like the perfect way to go.
Earl Grey.
All right, Riker, we're promoting you to captain. I mean, you killed the last captain. We usually don't reward that. That's usually not our policy, but in this case...
Well, to be fair, he had spent some time on a Klingon ship.
The Orb.
But the Federation and Bajor, as a member of the Federation, would be helping rebuild Cardassia. And I could see, like, very much the relationship between the U.S. and Japan today. I could see the Federation and Cardassia having that kind of relationship moving forward.
To the journey!
Janeway has a very distinct pain noise.
Yeah, she kind of does.
You know what I'm talking about?
It sounds sort of like she's suffocating.
Yeah, it sounds like she's suffocating and sometimes, and I'm going to keep it clean, not always in pain.
The Ready Room.
He is the best cosplayer ever because he's so buried himself in his part that we have no idea who this guy is outside of the impersonation of Tuvok.
Exactly.
He's the Christian Bale of the Delta Quadrant.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
If I'm not mistaken, in any upcoming episode of Next Generation, we don't see full-grown golden retrievers running around the decks of the Enterprise. And I'm also a little worried that Captain Picard has never played with puppies.
Commentary, Trek stars.
But you'd rather see Red in charge than him.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right.
Because you really want porn stash to go down.
Yes, yes, you do. And that sentence out of context sounds really strange.
Literary Treks.
As great as Picard is and his Picard maneuver, I don't think Picard straightening his shirt is going to help him when he's going up against the Riker maneuver.
Fair enough, yeah.
So. Axanar, the official podcast.
The changes that we've made, the change to the nacelles and several other aspects of these ships to make them distinct and not the same ships as in Star Trek 2009.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find them everywhere you get your podcasts. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone. We're on SoundCloud as well, also Spreaker, BlackBerry. You can even go to the website and stream from the show page or download the MP3 file and grab the RSS link and pop that into any third-party application that you like. You'll find all of that there on the show page on our website at trek.fm. And while you're in iTunes and on Stitcher, take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear from you. We love to hear what you think about the show. And those also help us rise up in the search results and make it easier for other Star Trek fans to find the Ready Room as they're searching for Star Trek podcasts. And another way you can help out the network, if you would like to help us keep Star Trek conversation coming to you every day of the week, is to become a patron on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekafilm, that's patreon.com/trekafilm, you'll find different contribution levels and perks there. You can set any amount that you want, but we do have some things outlined so that you know what we offer as perks in exchange for certain levels. And Patreon, it's a lot like Kickstarter, but it's a way for you to support the creatives that you love on a month-to-month basis. We have many great patrons supporting us there right now. We hope that you'll join them as well. And we'd also like to thank our associate producer, Renee Roberts, who supports us through Patreon. Renee has been with us here on the network really since the beginning. I mean, Renee was here 4 years ago, more than 4 years ago when I started Trek FM. She's been a wonderful supporter and we really thank her for all she does for the network. And you can follow Renee on Twitter at @Mress_1701. That's Mress, M-R-E-S-S, just like the feline officer from the animated series. So thank you so much, Renee. Now, if you would like to send us some feedback on today's show, there are many ways for you to get in touch with us. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. On Facebook, our regular page is facebook.com/trekfm, but you can also join us in the Babel Conference, which is our dedicated group for listeners. And that is a closed group, so as I mentioned in the news segment, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. It'll come right up. Just click join. I'll let you right on in there. We have hundreds of people in that group, and we have great conversations every single day, so we hope you'll join us over there. Now, Tommy, if people want to find you, keep up with what's going on with Star Trek Horizon, of course, and all the other things that you do, where should they go?
Well, the main place that I usually post is on the Horizon Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/sthorizon. It's all one word, or you can just search for Star Trek Horizon on Facebook. You can also find us at our official website, startrekhorizon.com. And I also have my wonderful Twitter handle that I don't post that too often, but I do on occasion, and it's Tommy G Dog, or as Chris likes to refer to it, Tommy G Doggy Dog.
That's right. You always have to break it out when you're talking to me, though. You've got to bring it up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't always bring it up because I don't actually post that often, but it's special for you, Chris.
That's right.
And that's Tommy G, the letter G, D-A-W-G, because
yeah, right.
Why not?
So one more thing about your contact information. Now, people are going to go, they're going to check out Horizon. Your Kickstarter happened a long time ago, but if people want to pitch in and support what you're doing, how can they do that?
Yes, actually, we do. We're accepting donations via PayPal. And while there aren't as many donation tiers as there were for Kickstarter, we do have a number available. And all you have to do is go to our website, StarTrekHorizon.com, and click on the Support Us section. And there are a number of options there where people can donate via PayPal. And as rewards for their donation, they can receive a copy of the film on DVD or Blu-ray or a copy of the soundtrack, etc.
Awesome. Great. And maybe if they contribute enough, you can even sew a uniform for them. That was actually one of your Kickstarter perks, wasn't it?
That was one of my Kickstarter perks. And luckily, the people that donated on Kickstarter only went for the Admiral's jacket. Luckily for me. So I only have to sew a number of Admiral's jackets for people.
All right. Maybe I'll hop on, contribute something so I can get one of those Romulan uniforms.
just for you, I'll get you a Romulan uniform.
All right. I'll put it on my chair when I'm not wearing it around town, since it's
the perfect fabric for that. No, you would look incredibly fantastic wearing that around town. You would definitely get looks.
I'll get some extra space on the train when I sit down wearing that, right?
Yeah.
All right, great. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. You can also find me on Facebook with that same name. And in the Babel Conference, I do try to contribute there as much as I can. My online time's been a little bit tight these days, as everyone knows, but that's starting to open up a little bit, so I should be around there a bit more. And then here on the network, I'm only doing two shows these days, this one, and I'm also doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, so you can catch me on those two shows. If you'd like to hear some of my other thoughts on the world of Star Trek, and of course DS9 there on The Orb. Well, Tommy, I'm going to have to let you go. I've got to head down and pick up T'Pol. She's invited me to be her date for Bride of Frankenstein.
Well, that sounds like an incredibly fun time. Hopefully you can read through the book as well. And for me, it's time to stick a Pop-Tart in it, because the Ready Room is done.